Okay, thank you. So I'll be talking about a rather different physical situation than we just heard about. I will spend most of my time talking about calculations of hydrodynamics. So this is not MHD limit, but hydrodynamics limit. And also, I will go to radiation-dominated situation. So, for example, the accretion disk will be geometrically thin, optically thick. So these are two important changes. So I would want you to know about them, because you probably would like to make connection between what I'm going to say and what the previous speaker were talking about. I may mention something about jets, but not directly. So the outline of my talk is introduction to outflows in AGN, and then I will spend most of my time presenting you results from hydrodynamical simulations, and I will mention briefly MHD simulations. So the key here is that we do see AGN from very far. So they do radiate a lot of radiation. So photons are very important. So if someone wants to to see an equation, so what we see is because we accrete energy onto a compact object, which is a black hole, and this parameter is very high. So this is not about radiation inefficient flows, it is about radiation efficient flows. So we heard about the outflows from AGN yesterday and also today. So I just want to, as a motivation for my calculation, to say that outflows are basically another aspect of activity in galactic centers. So they are common and they are important, because if the outflows are powerful, they can contribute significantly to the total budget. Mass accretion rate can be modified by the mass loss rate. We've heard some observers making statements about that, because outflows are between the source of the photons and us. They can change radiation properties of what we see. The outflows can also interact with what is around the black hole on large scales and on small scales. And we also heard that perhaps outflows are required to collimate flows from much closer in, to collimate a jet. So there are many questions. Where do the outflows come from? How do they avoid full ionization? This is the key problem as far as theory is concerned, because we see outflows through absorption lines in the UV. On the other hand, we see the same sources being very strong X-ray sources. So the flow probably sees the X-rays too, but it does not suffer from full ionization. The geometry of the outflow is important. And what are the forces driving them? And then, if we answer all those these questions, then we can answer what is actually the mass loss rate, what is the velocity. I just want to say the mass loss rate, when it's mentioned by observers, is usually, I think, overestimated. So accretion disks are most plausible locations where the outflow comes from. So I will basically assume that. What can drive an outflow? Well, we basically had three choices. Thermal expansion, when the thermal velocity is higher than the escape velocity, then the gas can leave the system and never come back. Magnetic fields, so we heard mostly about their roles during this meeting so far. And radiation pressure, and I will focus on that. Why radiation pressure? Well, to have an outflow, you want to have radiation so strong that the pressure will be higher than gravity. So then there's this concept of Eddington number, or Eddington luminosity. So now what I'm going to tell you is, what do I mean by luminous accretion disks? We can have an outflow even if the luminosity is less than Eddington limit, where we have basically enough opacity. This is a UV spectrum of a quasar. where you can see that the continuum is very much damaged. There are lots of broad absorption lines, and there are also emission lines. If we assume that intrinsic radiation was the continuum, then you see that matter was interacting with the radiation a lot. In particular, matter was gaining momentum as well as energy from the radiation. So this is almost a direct evidence that radiation pressure is important. To make a connection between lots of different astrophysical systems, I'm going to draw something what I call the big picture. So that for that, I need to remind you what is the Eddington luminosity. What would be the actual luminosity for an accretion disk? And for me, it's two numbers are important. What is the ratio between actual luminosity and Eddington luminosity? So this is Eddington factor. And what is the Eddington factor for UV radiation only? I'll spend most of my time on talking about interaction of continuum photons with spectral lines in the UV band, because there are so many strong lines in the UV, and this is all because of atomic data. To have an outflow, using those general physical arguments, you can say that this is supposed to be UV, that the Eddington number in the UV times total luminosity due to lines should be higher than 1. Then there is a chance that gravity will be overcome by radiation pressure. It is interesting to explore what happens for different systems, different accretors, when you have a given mass accretion rate. So that gives you, for a given accretor, an Eddington factor, and Eddington factor in the UV. And this plot shows that for about half a dozen different accretors. So here is the total Eddington factor. Here is the Eddington factor due to UV radiation only. I computed the latter by assuming standard accretion disk and integrated the intensity within UV band. This horizontal line is 1 over total luminosity, UV opacity. If you want an outflow, your system or systems have to live somewhere here. This number, however, is a function of ionizing radiation too. This particular value used here is about 4,000 and is the most favorable situation for driving wind in the UV. As the ionization of the gas would go up, this line would go up too. That means that the system would have to be really very luminous in the total sense and in a UV sense. Different lines are for different accretors. This is a supermassive black hole as an accretor, and this is how Eddington factor in the UV scales with the total luminosity. So quasars are very luminous accretors, and they occupy this part of this diagram. So they are far above the limit, which is a good news, because observations show that 10% of quasars have broad absorption lines. We have also systems called cataclysmic variables where the accretor is a white dwarf, so mass about 1 solar mass. Those systems are bright, but they are not as luminous in terms of Eddington number. They live somewhere here. What is interesting about those systems is that they are in a low and high state. When they are in the low state, the spectrum is more or less multi-temperature black body. There is no much sign of absorption lines, the emission lines. However, when the luminosity goes up by a factor of 2 or 3, you start seeing classical P-Cygni line profiles, which are associated with the outflows. So the fact that those systems occupy this part of this diagram makes sense, because what we probably see in observations is the switch-on, switch-off situation for line driving. When they are in the low state, we are roughly below that line. And very little it takes to cross that line, and then the lines are seen and outflow is produced. There are also systems like young stellar objects where the accretor is the main sequence star, and they live somewhere here. They are known to have jets and also molecular outflow. I'm not going as far as claiming that the outflows are radiation driven, but they have wings and they have right properties. For this picture to be correct, you also want to say what happens to the systems which are not known to be UV absorbers. Those are neutron star accretors. They are very bright. Despite of that, they are here. And they are not known to have absorptions in the UV. Another case are black hole, galactic black hole candidates, or, for example, low mass X-ray binaries. They are, again, very bright, but the luminosity in the UV is so low that they are, again, very close, if not below that line. So this big picture tells you which system should have UV absorbers and which should not. And it's consistent, I would argue, with the general knowledge coming from observations. So that brings me to the motivation. What I'll be talking about for the rest of the talk is trying to answer the question, what happens when you have flat disk, which will be a good emitter? At each location, it will emit radiation according to black body. Will it produce a wind? Will this wind be successful, or it will just puff up the disk? I'm not going to talk about local simulations. I'll be talking about global simulations designed specifically to address outflows in quasars. So here's the general picture. Here's the accretion disk. It is radiation dominated at smaller radii and gas pressure dominated at large radii. It's rotating with the black hole sitting somewhere here. This is a source of continuum photons in the UV, and this is the central engine which emits radiation in the UV and X-rays. And this represents my computational domain, and I'm asking what will be here if I will have a reservoir of gas sitting on the Keplerian orbits and radiating through the photosphere. A nasty element of these calculations is that you have to calculate the radiation force from the entire disk. But that has been accomplished. So to run the simulations, you have to specify the mass of the accretor, the radiation field of the disk, and the central object, which is tied to the accretion rate. And a very important element is spectral energy distribution. So let me talk about case one, when I have mostly UV, so which is a good thing for radiation driving through the UV lines, because the gas will not suffer from full ionization. This is the case for black holes of 10 to the 8 with a highish mass accretion rate corresponding to 50% of Eddington luminosity. Rotational axis is here. This will be a movie showing density maps. This is the thin accretion disk. This sphere represents the central source, which at this, for this calculation, radiation was switched off. So what you see is formation and development of the bipolar outflow with the mass flux density increasing with the decreasing radius. So most of the power in the wind is somewhere here, which I called a fast stream. So this proves that indeed, if you incorporate lines, a wind can be formed with the terminal velocity here corresponding to the escape velocity from here, the factor of 2 or 3. Excuse me? The gas is here. It's an accretion disk, which is in these calculations considered as the lower boundary for the problem. So what I do is along the equator, I set the density at a given value, and I reset it at every time step at every location. And the other parameters of the lower boundary, I can explain later. So here is the density map again, with the direction of the velocity field here. And here's the density map, the temperature map. And you can play with the luminosity of the disk and the luminosity of the central object and you can have qualitative and quantitative changes in the solution for the wind. Basically, what happens when you increase the luminosity of the disk with no luminosity for the central object, that the wind becomes more and more polar. With the example here, where the luminosity is indeed very high. Is it the jet? Maybe. Is it the outflow that may collimate the jet? Perhaps. If you increase or add luminosity from the central object, this radiation in radial direction organizes the flow and pushes the flow towards the equator. What happens when you add radiation? These are applications of, I think I will skip that. Well, let me show you something before I go to the X-rays. Those winds can be applied to CVs, young stellar objects, and I could argue that they work pretty well, because for a given wind structure, you can compute synthetic line profiles for different inclinations and compare directly with observations, and here's an example. This is to explain only absorption, which is the blue shifted absorption. This curve is the X-ray observation for one of the CVs. And there are two lines, solid and dashed, for different inclination angles, which bracket the observed inclination angle of 55 degrees. And it looks quite good. So what will happen when we add X-rays? So this was the first case. UV emitting disk, photons, a wind was formed. Now we will add a component that there is a source of radiation, patchy or some kind of this corona. So we are now shining X-rays onto this. And the best thing to do, I thought, is to stop the simulations without X-rays, add the X-rays, and continue the simulations. And this movie starts where the previous movie ended. When you add X-rays, there is a gas which at small radii sees this X-rays and it's fully ionized, cannot reach escape velocities, and starts to fall back on the wind, on the disk at larger radii. However, the wind which is launched from larger radii is shielded from the X-rays and can escape the system. Here is the difference between no X-ray case and X-ray case. There is change in the temperature distribution. Here everything is fully ionized. Here gas is at the appropriate ionization state and can be driven by radiation in lines. You can apply that and compute lines and see if they are consistent with observations of broad absorption lines. And these are few inclination angles. The bottom line is here that for certain inclination angles, line is very broad and blue shifted. You can compare this directly with observations, and if anything, it is encouraging. The line fails in explaining the emission, but emission was taken out in the simulation. Explains very well the deep saturated absorption, and and when you add emission, you see that emission basically fills in absorption in the wings, which is caused by rotation of the outflow, not expansion. I just say that these solutions are very sensitive to the key parameters, to the mass of the black hole or the luminosity of the disk. Here I increase luminosity of the disk, it is 90% now, but the mass of the black hole is reduced by a factor of 100. What happens here? A wind is launched, but it's not dense enough to shield itself from the X-rays, so it goes up and fails. So this, coming back to the big picture, tells us that systems like quasars may have winds driven by radiation, but systems like Seyferts with less massive black holes should not have such winds. So, assuming origin of the outflow and taking very reasonable assumption about radiation, we answer quite positively and I thought insightfully the key elements of absorption. And my time is up, so I can say what happens when you add magnetic fields, but probably don't have time for this now. Or I do. Thank you. Okay. What I found is that then two wings basically appear. At small radii, the presence of the magnetic field does not change dynamics and structure of the wing. This wing was launched and accelerated by radiation. However, at larger radii, in the standard accretion disk, temperature of the disk goes down with radius quite quickly, magnetic fields start to play an important role. And in particular, they launch through the pressure of the radial magnetic field a wind which is dense. And dense, high density for light driving is a bad news because the wind then is optically thick. So here, the wind is launched and accelerated by magnetic fields all the time. So it is not it is a hybrid model, but basically you are dealing with two winds. Magnetic fields increases a lot the mass accretion rate, but of the component which is slow. So that's when you compute synthetic line profiles based on these calculations, you will have distinctively different line profiles. So that's a call to see what causes what.
When you did the X-ray illumination of the wind, what was the ratio of power in X-rays to power in the UV, and what was the X-ray spectral index, and did you try varying those parameters to see what happened?
Yes, I showed you one example when I varied the luminosity of X-rays down to zero. In the case where X-rays was non-zero, it was 50%. My calculations of the photoionization structure are giving me only the rough idea about this, what is the temperature and photoionization state for a given photoionization parameter. So I cannot directly model such things like dependence of my results on the slope of the power law. But the design of the calculations I showed you was such that I wanted to explore most unfavorable condition for this thing to work. So I think whatever I would try to do next, I would improve the power of the wind and make it weak.
Do you get acceleration through most of your domain, or does it accelerate and then reach some terminal speed?
The physical base for these calculations is borrowed from winds from OB stars, and many of the properties of the disk winds are as in the OB stars, in particular the size of the acceleration zone. It is of order of 3 or 5 of the radius where the wind was launched from.
Thank you.
So at the outer boundary, my wind is not accelerating anymore.
In each of your examples, there seemed to be a particular range of radii from which the mass flux was greatest. Now, is that determined by, for example, the local effective temperature?
Correct. So in those calculations, line driving in the UV operates when you have plenty of UV photons. So basically, you didn't see wind coming off the disk at large radii because the disk there was cooler than 10,000 Kelvin.
So is 10,000 Kelvin the ideal temperature for launching?
It doesn't really matter. Something between 10 and 50. When you go above 50, you then lose many lines, and there's a mismatch between distribution of lines and the continuum photons.
Okay, just comment. If you have this favored temperature, then that suggests that if the saturation speed is related to the orbital speed at the liftoff point, that as the mass increases, The liftoff point has to go in to smaller R over RG and therefore larger saturation speed.
Right.
In OB stars, the line-driven winds are mainly due to Doppler gradient of speed. But in accretion disk, there is an additional source of shifting. It's gravitational shifting. So have you taken into account this?
I'm aware of some work from people in Moscow who argue that for radii less than 20 or so black holes, the redshift due to gravitational redshift should be taken into account. I haven't done that. The problem here I see is that, do you have any gas which will have UV lines available? If not, then we may need to rely on lines in X-rays. But it's an interesting question. What will happen then?
Is it possible that you have a dust component in your wind so that the radiation interaction with the wind is modified by that?
Well, yes, some people propose that as the gas flows out, it cools down and dust forms. My computational domain is not big enough to capture, I think, this transition. Also, my calculations do not include appropriate microphysics to model this transition. So maybe in the future, me or someone else will do it.
Roger? If you looked at, I mean, you started to do some of this, but if you looked ahead to trying to understand broad absorption line quasars, what fraction of optical quasars do you think would exhibit broad absorption lines when you average over all the viewing directions?
Okay. So that brings me to the issue, shall we believe or not into the unification model, meaning that all quasars are the same and observers see them differently only because of the inclination angle.
Well, it's not the only factor.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's why I explored what happens when I start to play with the key parameters of my model, which is the mass of the black hole and the luminosity of the wind. And what I found is that if I reduce the luminosity of the disk from 50% to 30%, there's no successful wind anymore. The same, so the wind solution is a very sensitive function to the luminosity of the disk and to the mass of the black hole. So answering your question, it is difficult. I can make an estimate how things would look like statistically if I will, for a given model, but that would require me to assume that all quasars are the same. In particular, all quasars have the same mass of the black hole and the same luminosity. If they don't, things become more complicated, and I don't know the answer to this question.
Just a wonderful problem with an outgoing gradient. What fraction of the sky would see the quasar?
So that would be somewhere from here to there. So that would be, say, 20%. But 20%, okay. The question is, what will happen if I will look at the system almost H on? Yeah, but let me start from H on. Because this wind is so thick, I think that we wouldn't recognize or we wouldn't detect a source like that at all. Even in high direct X-rays, the column densities are huge. So this system can be recognized as a quasar only if viewed for inclination angles between 0 and, say, 70 degrees. And within inclination angle between 60 and 70, you would see this as a broad absorption line quasar. For lower inclinations, it would be just a quasar without broad absorption lines. Broad absorption lines.
Yeah. I was just wondering, when you included the x-rays, there seemed to be, without the x-rays, you went to a nice steady state. With the x-rays, there seemed to be some modulation. I wouldn't say it was periodic, but there was definitely a modulation of MDOT. And I was just wondering if you could comment on the time scale and why.
Yeah, this is of order of the dynamical time scale at that location. So what is happening there is that you saw this puffing up, that kind of smoke. So the reason was that as dense gas from smaller radii was lifted and over-ionized, it was falling down. And every now and then, somewhere there, the density can be very low, and the gas is very well shielded, and radiation force then can accelerate the gas very quickly. So the fact that this gas is over-ionized doesn't really matter, because it flies anyway. So it's a matter where the over-ionization occurs. If it occurs when the gas is already with the velocity above the escape velocity, it basically flies away. So that is a manifestation of this principle, what you see there. Yeah.
While you were talking about near Eddington disks, I was reminded of an instability, a warping instability that Pringle predicted for near Eddington disks, driven by radiation pressure. And the assumptions of that model basically are that the disk is irradiated from the central source and then re-radiates isotropically. And under those assumptions, you can show that the momentum tends to drive a warping. But in this picture, where there's a wind, it's not obvious to me that that instability will operate at all, because the X-ray, whether it's X-rays or UV, the light that's absorbed by the disk is actually maybe absorbed by unbound material, which simply flies off without transferring the momentum. Have you thought at all of
that's
the implications
right.
of this picture for
yes.
working?
Both James and me were discussing this, and I remember the conclusion correct, it is that it depends where the interaction of the irradiation and the gas occurs. If it occurs when the wind is already supersonic, then this wind feels this radiation pressure, but it's probably not communicating back with the accretion disk. So the roping of the disk, I think, then does not occur.
Okay, it's tea time, back at 4 o'clock.